Hello and welcome to NJ Biz Conversations. I'm your host, Jeff Kanige. My guest today is William Barrett. He is the CEO of Mandelbaum Barrett, as you can see, which is a law firm in Roseland. William, welcome.
Thanks for having me on, Jeff.
I appreciate you taking the time. And the reason I was interested in talking to you is a phenomenon that I've heard more and more about over the past, say, 6 to 8 months, particularly since the pandemic, really, is that business owners starting to get to the point where they want to leave their business. They've started it, they've worked in it their whole life or most of their lives. And now they've gotten to the point where either they're reaching retirement age or after a really difficult few years, they've just decided they've had enough. You recently ran a seminar in this very subject, which I'm told was fairly well attended. So obviously it was a success. What led you to believe? What were you hearing? What were you hearing from clients, from people you know, that led you to believe that an event like that would be useful?
Sure. Yeah. We've been doing an exit strategy seminar going back probably 3-4 years prior to the pandemic, and then it got tabled obviously with the pandemic. And this was the first time we brought it back since. And so we've always known that it's been very popular in. But this, you know, let's say in the past, we would average 40, 50 attendees. I think we had about 85 attendees at this one. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons why I think it's popular. And I think part of it is, too, that there's a ton of money out there to deploy. And I think investors, you know, and this is just my personal opinion, investors look at the volatility of institutional investments and they're looking at these kind of tried and true, closely held private businesses that, you know, have withstood tough times, thrived in good times, and they've been around, which kind of really is the majority of our clientele, are these type of closely held companies.
Okay.
And I think part of it is, too, that people are hearing a lot about valuations. They're hearing about big dollars being paid for businesses, and it kind of piques their curiosity as to what's going on out there in the market and in different spaces. And when they hear some of the numbers being thrown around, it they say to themselves, "Well, wow, that's such a bigger number than I ever thought a business like mine would be worth.
Right,
maybe I need to look at this."
Okay. All right. Well, that's I want to talk about A, valuations, and B, the buyers, the kinds of buyers you're seeing. But first, I want to start on the selling side, and that is, you have someone comes to you and they say exactly that or something like that. I'm ready to retire. I'm hearing about all these valuations and what folks are getting for their businesses. What are the main things that they need to think about if they're going to make that decision and actually try to sell the business?
Yeah, I think one of the overriding themes that seems to come out of every one of these exit strategy seminars is kind of talking a lot with the business owners about preparation. You know, you don't just say, "Hey, I think this is the right time. I'm going to market next month."
Okay.
You know, in fact, you know, what we generally recommend for our clients is actually pull out due diligence checklists from transactions of similar type.
Okay.
And I also take the representation and warranty section of a typical asset purchase agreement, and I pluck out just the section on representations and warranties. And I sit with them and show it to them really for the sole purpose of kind of getting them to understand the type of scrutiny that they're going to come under when they venture into this space. And, you know, not just from maybe the professionals that are helping them, but the professionals that are going to be assisting a buyer, and, you know, the types of questions they're going to ask and the things they need to be able to represent, many of which, if you're running your own closely held business and you're just going about your daily routine and things have worked for you a certain way for a long time, you might not even be aware of the fact that you might be doing something that a buyer looks at as problematic or non-compliant. And it's the time to kind of fix all those things in advance of going to the market and to dispose of potential, you know, trauma or drama. You know, for example, has somebody's maybe threatened a lawsuit, or maybe there's, you know, a lawsuit that you have that's out there that you could really settle it, but as a matter of principle, you're continuing to argue it. it gets into all those types of conversations about kind of going into it with a clean slate so that you look attractive to an acquirer.
Okay. All right. Is it fair to say that that kind of due diligence may be more scrutiny than some of these folks have ever had before? I mean, is that what you're telling them?
I would tell you that a big part of what I do and have done for the last 25 years in this space is, in some respect, it's like acting like a psychiatrist, especially for a closely held business owner who has never come under this scrutiny before. And because in most instances, I mean, there's always exceptions, but in most instances, people have spent a lifetime, sometimes multiple generations, building this business, this enterprise, and they haven't, you know, maybe they did, some small acquisitions on their own,
right.
But for the most part, they've never come under this kind of scrutiny. So it's preparing them for that. And also just preparing them for the process, right? So, because I think that like a business owner gets asked for information, they provide it. And then when someone else asks them for the same piece of information again, sometimes they lose their mind, like as if that's crazy. Why would anyone be asking me for this again? I've already provided it.
Right.
And I'm there to tell them that you're probably going to get asked for it three times. You know, their lawyer's going to ask for it. The accountant's going to ask for it. The business person's going to ask for it. And, you know, you could direct them to the data room, or sometimes it's just easier to just hit the button again and send it to them. And I actually, in one of the books I wrote on mergers and acquisitions, I talked about the term that I like to use, deal fatigue. Mm-hmm. I try to prepare a closely held business owner in advance for the fact that the process is definitely, not to be cliche, but it's definitely a marathon and not a sprint. You know, it's understanding that you're going to be scrutinized. You're going to be asked for the same thing over and over. People might ask you questions that you feel maybe are kind of critical because they're digging at something and you suspect they think that maybe you're not doing something as well as it could have been done. There's all these things that get people to a point where they've been going on for several weeks and it's getting close to the closing and they get ready to throw their hands up and say, that's it. I'm just going to keep my business. I'm done with it. And part of our job is to keep them kind of focused on they came to us, and I always ask, the first question I always ask is, what's the ideal outcome, right? Okay. If you could write a script and the pages are blank, how would this all go you would think it was the ideal outcome? And then when we get to those rough spots, I try to remind them of, remember, the ideal outcome is still in reach. Stay the course. And that's sometimes the hardest part.
Right. Like, as they say on the Sopranos, it's not personal. It's just business. You have to keep that in mind.
Right. Especially when you're dealing with, private equity groups that are making acquisitions, you know, it's really all business. You know, right. Sometimes the transactions that I don't want to say feel better or people feel a different type of bond through the process is when, you know, one, let's say a friendly competitor or a colleague or somebody in the field that, you know, is buying your company, there's a much heightened level of respect for what you've done and what you've accomplished. You probably know each other from trade shows, or so it can be a very different experience. In private equity, it's really all business.
Okay. Given those parameters and the need to be honest and to make sure that you're not misrepresenting what the business is, are there things business owners can do to make their business more attractive at this point? I mean, when you get to the point where you're going to sell, are there things that they can do to increase the valuation to make the business a more inviting target?
Yeah, you have to almost flip it around and think about, if I were buying my company, what would worry me? Or to say it a different way, you know, what does keep me up at night? If I wasn't selling the company, what are the things that I worry about? And, you know, one example that, for example, is maybe a heavy customer concentration. You know, I had a client for many years that had a wonderful family business in New Jersey, and it had gone on, since the early 80s. And this was, you know, the business just basically closed about a year ago. And at one point they did try to go to the market, but they had about a 70% concentration with this one fabulous, great customer, you know, and without saying any names, a customer everybody would want to have.
Okay. Right.
You know, and it was profitable and they did incredibly well, but that was very unattractive because the risk profile, and because the customer was such a 800-pound gorilla, their contract gave them lots of rights because you're going to sign whatever they put in front of you, unfortunately, and they're not going to negotiate very much because everybody wants that deal. So you're not able to really get a great contract, and you've got this concentration that's a that can devalue things. Or if you have, for example, like a supply issue, like a unique vendor that, you know, I had another client once that made a product that there was really only a couple of companies, including one company that they did business with in Germany, that, you know, without getting too complicated, would have to extract this particular type of protein to be able to make their product work. And, you know, if anything happened with that vendor relationship, the company was at serious risk.
Right, right.
Other issues are key people,
sure.
Key salespeople. Do you have, you know, do you have good contracts with them? Do you have them kind of, all in on the company, locked up long term? Do you have reasonable restrictive covenants that, to protect the company? So things like that really jump to mind as things that, as you're preparing, you have to think about. I mean, look, nobody's going to turn away that great customer, but you have to realize that is going to greatly impact value if a huge percentage of your business comes from one customer.
Okay. All right. So let's talk a little bit about then the other side. First of all, you mentioned a lot of money out there. I'm guessing then the M&A market as a whole is fairly robust and around here these days.
Yeah. And, it's interesting. I think it's like the segments that you're in, right? Because I was talking to a business broker just recently who does a lot in the region and in New Jersey. And he was kind of a little bit down on the M&A market. And, his bread and butter deals seem to be a lot of like owner to owner transactions in the small to middle market, areas where sometimes people are getting financing for those deals, personally, maybe they're doing large SBA loans, things like that. So his universe is actually kind of not doing so great, especially with the increase in interest rates and so forth. But on the flip side, there's a lot of areas that are like red hot, where, you feel like if you're in those segments, you're drinking from a fire hose. And I see that to be where there's consolidation going on, right? So some of the hot areas right now where it's just insane is in, believe it or not, dental and dental specialty.
Okay.
These private equity groups are gobbling up practices all over the United States, our region as well. Veterinary, another huge space. Another one that's been developing recently, and some large New Jersey accounting firms are in the mix here, is accounting firms.
Right, sure.
So
Belco just recently.
Yeah, and so you're talking about some large as well as mid-size, and you could see these businesses that kind of evolve sometimes, especially at the smaller level, in what I'll describe as kind of like a parochial way. And the easy one to look at is dental, right? Mm-hmm. Where can have a center of a town, and on every corner there's a dental practice,
right?
And someone just has to look at it and say, every one of those practices has an office manager, everyone has someone sitting at the front desk, everyone has an assistant, they're all paying rent, they're all paying insurance, just the basic common sense things. And you realize, wow, if you had one really nice facility where these people all worked in a group practice, think of the efficiencies. So I think that that's an area that, it's hot. And you look at the accounting firms, it's the same thing. Another thing that's just emerging right now is behavioral health consulting firms.
Oh, really? Okay.
That's kind of like I'll call it a developing hot soon, or maybe soon to be hot area. And again, the themes are all the same. In fact, I will tell you that, we're working on some accounting firm transactions right now. And I was looking at the, you see a lot of deals come across your desk, and I'm looking at the format of the letter of intent. And it's like, when you get that feeling like you've seen this before, you're like, but not just that you've seen the letter of intent, of course, but like the way it's even laid out, the font, the logo, it looks like something I've seen before. And you know, so we pulled out a consolidation deal from a private equity group involving dental, and then looked at this one where there's an acquisition of an accounting firm, and sure enough, it's the same group, and they're even structuring the deal in terms of the terms, you know, how much cash, how much equity, you know, the employment agreements, all those things. When you go and compare them, they're structuring the deals exactly the same. I mean, right down to, you know, the paragraphs of the two letters of intent for completely different industries were almost identical. So in these spaces, I don't mean to like drag it out, but in these spaces, I mean, it is extremely hot right now. So I think on some level, it just depends who you talk to as to like whether or not the M&A market is on fire or cold.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it's interesting. You mentioned veterinary. I spoke recently, Kevin Moyer of Sachs, who did a seminar on M&A investment in the veterinary industry, and he was seeing mostly private equity firms. What I'm hearing you saying is that that's what you're seeing too. There aren't a lot of strategic buyers out there. It's mostly private equity firms doing these roll ups. Is that what has that been your experience?
It is, and you know, there were historically kind of what I'll call traditional or fundamental ways that these types of businesses were valued. And they were usually a percentage of the gross receipts, sometimes a weighted average over a period of a few years.
Okay.
And that's how they arrived at value. And then what happens with these types of deals and why I think that there's not a lot of strategics going on. If I'm a strategic for the moment, let's assume I'm a pretty good sized practice, to use your veterinary example. And I'm thinking about making an acquisition. The first thing is I'm probably competing against the private equity group and I'm competing on value, you know, right, what I think it's worth versus what they think it's worth. And then I end up looking at, if I'm that doctor, that group, I look at, well, what's our practice worth? And because private equity is looking at it as a return on investment on their capital versus if I'm an actual entrepreneur, and I not only have to take a loan from the bank and pay that, but I have to pay the bills, I have to eat. So a lot of these doctors, believe it or not, even if they've been practicing a while, they have student loans because they borrowed, you know, close to $1 million by the time they were all done. So you look at that and the valuations and offerings coming from the private equity group, because they're viewing the whole model differently, are sometimes double and sometimes more, but I consistently see at least double what the traditional valuation would have yielded. So all of a sudden, if I'm the strategic that was thinking about an acquisition, I start thinking about my own sale because I'm looking at numbers and I'm saying, holy cow, really? Somebody would pay me that for my practice?
Okay. All right. And those valuations are holding up in the face of, you know, let's face it, there's some economic uncertainty. Cost of borrowing is going up. That hasn't really slowed down in these areas where you're talking about where it's really hot. Those kinds of concerns it doesn't sound like they're really slowing things down.
You know what? I haven't seen slowdown in deal volume. In fact, in some respects, I've seen increase. But what I have seen is a little bit more of a conservative approach in terms of, you know, how far a group will reach for a business they're interested in. So prior to kind of the economic uncertainty and the increase in interest rates in particular, you know, a lot of these groups had facilities that were at historic low rates, and they would reach a little bit, maybe pay a bigger multiple than they otherwise wanted to, but they wanted to get this business into the fold. Now I'm seeing groups holding at their numbers, staying very principled and saying, hey, look, you know, this is the biggest multiple we're going to pay. And if that's not good, no hard feelings,
right.
You know, I'm seeing more conservative approach to the deals. You know, there's also some of these groups, and it always happens, that got too aggressive in the good times, and you already hear the rumors out there about, oh, this group's not doing acquisitions anymore. I heard they fired their CEO, you know, and you know that that's the beginning sign of trouble. And and I see it all the time because we're in the deals. Sometimes I'll look at, you know, the financials and a letter of intent or a deal as it's blossoming, and I'll look at what's being offered and I'll say, you know, for a relatively average business, they seem to be paying an awful lot. I always watch those groups because the ones that don't stick to their principles and overreach are the ones that you end up hearing these stories about. And right now, those rumblings are already happening out there where in our New Jersey market, for example, there's a couple of dental support organizations, these private equity backed DSOs that were doing a lot of acquisitions in New Jersey, and a number of them have stopped acquiring altogether. Okay. And in essence are now trying to reorganize. They're trying to get their house in order. They're trying to kind of get the existing businesses they bought performing. That's always the first, because I've seen it happen before. It's always the first bad sign where there might be trouble on the horizon for those who kind of bought like drunken sailors for a few years.
Okay. All right. Well, that was actually going to be the last thing I asked you, was what you think the outlook is for the next, say, well, through the end of the year and then into 2024. I mean, there has been a lot of talk about a potential downturn in the second half. There's all sorts of geopolitical risk going on. And in as we get into 2024, you said you're starting to see some signs in some places. What are you expecting? What are you planning for the rest of the year and into 2024?
Yeah, I think, you know, we've been growing exponentially as a firm for a number of years now. And we've continued to grow. We've added people this year. Our headcount has gone up. But I'm definitely being, as a managing partner, I'm definitely being much more, you know, ultra cautious and conservative, and really, you know, probably upping the analytics on that quite a bit. In essence, trying to do more with less in the short term.
Okay.
And while you're incredibly busy, which we are, a lot of times your colleagues look at you like, really? Like, we're not going to add some resources here? And from my perspective, I'm saying we might, but because of, as you outlined, I mean, you laid out all this uncertainty. I feel like some of the niche markets that we're in, just, you know, maybe some of it's a blessing, it's luck, whatever you want to call it. I feel like we're going to be very busy, but I feel like there is a lot of uncertainty. For example, I already see in real estate verticals.
Okay.
There's no doubt in my mind in real estate verticals that you're seeing a slowdown. Bank lending, obviously, I you know, I've seen, you know, just less deals. I mean, it's not that banks don't have tons of money that they want to lend. They do. So we haven't reached one of those types of economies or markets where the banks are saying, we don't want to lend to you. In fact, they do. But, you know, think about it, right? If you're a real estate developer, entrepreneur, or, you know, you're regularly in the market and you've got assets that you're holding, and in the last few years, you know, you've been doing deals at 2% and 3%, and you have several years left on those deals, you know, you're really not that interested right now in refinancing.
Right.
And because of the uncertainty, people are sitting on development opportunities, I think, a little bit more. So, I mean, it's just what I see. So I think that you're going to see that certain areas will suffer, I think, more than others. But it is, you know, I guess we all always like to say it's unprecedented times, but I guess really it's just times, right?
Yeah.
Because we go through this every so many years, you know, we go through, and you never know what the triggering event's going to be. I mean, right now you've got, you know, you've got a war going on, you know, in Ukraine. You've got, you know, the heating up of a presidential race. You've got all sorts of litigation surrounding all of that. You know, uncertainty in the economy, debt ceiling issues. I mean, you could make a giant laundry list of all the things that could go wrong. And, you know, hopefully with a little luck, and hopefully for all of us headquartered in New Jersey, you know, that we fall on the right side of all these things, which would be great. But you just got to be prepared for it. And, you know, there is a lot of uncertainty right now. There's no doubt.
Okay. Well, on that semi-optimistic note, we will leave it there. I hope you'll come back and talk some more about this. This is a fascinating subject, and it would be interesting to sort of look again in a few months to see how some of these things pan out.
I would love that. We'll go back and watch the tape and see where we predicted right and wrong, which is, you know, hopefully more right than wrong.
Very good.
All right, William Jeff, Barrett, thank you so much.
Mandelbaum, yes, thank you. William Barrett of Mandelbaum Barrett in Roseland. Thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Take care.
And thank you for watching. Until next time, stay safe, everyone.